This is edition number 2028 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 31st of July 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 30th of July 2026. My name is Pauline Andrews and my fellow readers are
Dorry Brecken,
Chris Lodes
and Bo Williams.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5:15 and will set at about 8:45.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes the rapture of reading about a raptor, the Heidi High heritage holidays of the 1950s and 60s, a chain-smoking sweetheart still sung about on YouTube, and some of the notes sung by our feathered friends.
But we begin with the main news items, which include an update on the current hosepipe ban, after hearing about an unsuspicious but sad death in Aylsham, warnings about the so-called Nottingham knockers in the area, statistics on the police operation Foxtail, and an urgent recall on a specific brand and batch of milk. Let's start with those lead stories.
A woman in her 50s has died after an incident in a town centre. Police were called to assist the ambulance services on Friday, July 24th at 3:47 p.m. after reports of a concern for safety at Aylsham Marketplace. A woman aged in her 50s was taken to hospital in a life-threatening condition, and a spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary has confirmed she has since died. The death is not being treated as suspicious, and a file will be prepared for the coroner, the spokeswoman added.
Homeowners are being warned to stay alert after reports of aggressive doorstep callers. So-called Nottingham knockers have been spotted in Reefham. According to Broadland Police, these individuals usually state they are ex-prisoners and try to sell goods. A spokesman for the force said, "This is a common technique used by criminals, and residents will sometimes be met with aggression from the sellers when refusing to buy anything. In these circumstances, we would advise residents to make sure their house is secure front and back before answering any doors. And if you don't recognise the person, to consider only speaking to them through a closed, locked door, if at all. Tell them you are not interested and ask them to leave, despite any persistence. Homeowners are advised not to agree to buy goods from or have work done by anyone who calls unannounced, as sometimes such traders are operating fraudulently and will target vulnerable residents."
Operation Foxtail, a crackdown on organised crime, which ran from July the 6th to July the 10th along the A11, targeted a range of offences, including immigration breaches, driving offences, fraud and drug-related crimes. It was backed by the Home Office and involved several partner agencies, including HMRC and the Driver and Vehicle Licensing Agency, DVLA, and the Driver and Vehicle Standards Agency, DVSA. Their combined efforts resulted in 47 arrests and 11 charges for offences such as possession of fraudulent driving licences, immigration violations, drug supply, possession of criminal property, driving while disqualified, and possession of a knife. Among those arrested was a man found with suspected illegal tobacco. Further checks revealed he was driving while disqualified and uninsured. HMRC also discovered he was using red diesel without justification. He was taken to Wyndham Police Investigation Centre, where approximately £5,000 was found hidden in his underwear, leading to an additional arrest on suspicion of money laundering. Another individual was stopped by police, who found about £8,000 in his vehicle's glove box. He had no licence, no insurance, and was in the country illegally. The suspect has since been charged and remains in custody. Sergeant Josh Preston said, "The results show our determination to target those involved in criminality, whether that is organised drug supply, immigration offences, fraud, or dangerous driving. By working alongside partner agencies, we are able to identify offenders, safeguard vulnerable people, and take positive action against those who seek to exploit communities or use Norfolk's road network to commit crime." A total of 56 vehicles were seized and 88 traffic offence reports issued during the operation.
Investigators have given an update on the Broads fire, which destroyed four boats and sent two people to hospital. The large blaze broke out at Broads Edge Marina on the River Ant in Stalham in the early morning on Friday, July the 17th. Eyewitnesses saw five fire engines, two fire investigation vehicles, and an air ambulance at the scene. David Adams, manager of the Broads Edge Marina, said two people aboard one boat were taken to hospital with minor burns and the other three boats were unoccupied. A spokesman for Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has confirmed, "We have concluded the cause of the fire was accidental. The flames were put out within 3 hours of the fire service being called out, with three of the boats left completely charred. The fire was likely caused by gas on one boat, which spread to three others," added Mr. Adams. "The River Ant was closed to boaters for some time due to the smoke." A spokesman for the Broads Authority said, "Boaters are urged to pass with caution as there are booms around the vessels to contain potential debris or pollution."
A hosepipe ban that has been in place for almost 2 weeks is to remain in place, Anglian Water has revealed. From 1 a.m. on July the 11th, people in parts of Norfolk and Suffolk were banned from using hosepipes to water gardens, clean vehicles or fill paddling pools under restrictions imposed by the company. The ban is the first of its kind in the region since 2012 and comes with the county currently enduring its third heatwave of the summer. Anglian Water confirmed that demand for water has fallen by 9% as a result of the ban. A spokesman for the company said, "We're incredibly grateful to customers across Norfolk and the wider region for the support they've shown since temporary hosepipe restrictions were introduced, which has seen demand for water fall by 9%. This is helping us to maintain supplies for customers." While temperatures have eased slightly, conditions remain very dry, and water resources and groundwater levels remain lower than we would normally expect for this time of year, with some rivers at exceptionally low levels. We've also stepped up our efforts to find and fix leaks as quickly as possible, with additional teams working across the region to help reduce leakage and protect supplies too. At this stage, there are no plans to lift the restrictions, and restrictions will remain in place for as long as they're needed to help protect water supplies and the environment. "We'd like to thank customers for their continued support. Every litre saved helps protect our region's water resources and gives rivers, reservoirs and groundwater a better chance to recover."
Villagers have voiced their frustration at a leaking pipe which has seen drinking water gushing down a drain for a month while they are living under a hosepipe ban. Water has been seeping out of the fault at Ames Court, Corston, since at least June the 29th, when it was reported to Anglian Water, almost a fortnight before the firm imposed the restrictions. Reverend Andrew Whitehead, who lives on Ames Court, described the situation as deeply frustrating. "We all know that water is a precious resource, especially during a heatwave and hosepipe ban," he said. "To see a leak like this going unrepaired for weeks, pouring fresh drinking water straight down the drain, is hard to accept." Liberal Democrat County Councillor Dave Thomas said, People are doing the right thing, but at the same time they are seeing thousands of litres of treated water disappear into the road day after day. If customers are expected to play their part, Anglian Water must do the same. An Anglian Water spokesman said its team was currently on the ground 24 hours a day fixing repairs. During periods of hot weather, the high temperatures can cause ground movement that results in an increase of burst water mains or leaks, he said. Our teams continue working hard through the hot weather to prioritise repairs that are having the greatest impact on customers' water supplies and those resulting in the highest water loss.
Urgent recall for milk. A do not consume warning has been issued for milk sold in Norfolk after antibiotics were found in the product. Norfolk retailers have been urged to remove batches of Graham's semi-skimmed milk due to potential contamination with veterinary medicines, including the antibiotic penicillin. The recall applies to Graham's Family Dairy semi-skim milk sold in England in 1 pint, 1 litre and 2 litre bottles, all with a use-by date of July the 31st, 2026. The Food Standard Agency, FSA, has advised that the milk is not safe to drink, particularly for those with an allergy to antibiotics. The FSA said the presence of veterinary medicines, including antibiotics in the product, may make it unsafe to consume and may be a possible health risk for anyone with an allergy to antibiotics, penicillin. The milk is reportedly sold in Tesco, Asda and Morrisons. The company that produces the product has apologised to customers and urged them not to drink the affected milk.
Bin collections will begin earlier in parts of Norfolk this week due to the high temperatures. Two councils have announced earlier start times for collections due to high temperatures being forecast. Brecon Council's crews are set to begin rounds at 6 a.m. instead of the usual 6:30 a.m., while North Norfolk District Council has advised that crews may be out slightly earlier than usual. It comes amid a yellow heat health alert that has been issued for the region. The alert announced by the UK Health Security Agency is in place until 9 a.m. tomorrow. Temperatures will top the 30 degrees centigrade mark in parts of Norfolk during the alert. The change is intended to help crews work more safely in the heat.
Our next few news stories involve issues involving charities, lifeboat call-outs and transport news in the area.
A lifeboat crew was tasked twice within minutes to two separate incidents off Norfolk's coast over the weekend. Wells RNLI's inshore lifeboat was called out on Sunday, July 26th, to two groups who had got into difficulty. The volunteer crew was first called out at 2:53 p.m. following reports of six people and a dog cut off by the incoming tide on the foreshore between Wells and Hocombe. However, the group managed to make it ashore without any help, and the boat was stood down. Just 2 minutes later, the crew was tasked with assisting RNLI lifeguards after reports of two swimmers in difficulty in the main harbour channel at Wells. A windsurfer was already helping the swimmers, who were clinging to his board until further assistance arrived. The swimmers were safely taken onto the lifeboat Peter Wilcox and returned to the main beach, where they were handed over to an RNLI lifeguard. Mandy Humphreys, Wells RNLI water safety officer and volunteer crew member, expressed gratitude to the windsurfer who supported the swimmers. She warned about the strong tidal currents in the harbour channel, which can be challenging even for confident swimmers, advising people to choose lifeguarded beaches and swim between the red and yellow flags. Miss Humphreys also cautioned about the quick rising tide around Wells and Hocombe, urging people to check tide times and allow ample time to return to the main beach or dry land. The incidents came just a day after World Drowning Prevention Day, which Wells Coast Guard rescue team used to offer advice to those going near water. Advice includes always swimming in a pair or group and wearing a life jacket. In case of water difficulties, Miss Humphreys advised people to float to live and to call 999 or 112 for the Coast Guard if someone is in trouble at the coast.
After more than four decades on the front line, a Cromer Coast Guard has retired from the service. Jim Lilly has stood down after 42 years with HM Coast Guard Cromer, during which time he attended thousands of incidents. His work ranged from rescues involving helicopter crashes and emergencies involving boats to helping rescue people stranded on cliffs and at sea. Mr. Lilly was recognised by the Chief Coast Guard's commendation for a cliff rescue carried out during a snowstorm in Munsley around 20 years ago. He also received a certificate of commendation for the rescue of a swimmer in Sheringham 2 years ago. The team at Cromer's Coast Guard said Mr. Lilly's knowledge, experience and dedication have made a lasting impact on the team and local community, and they wished him a long, happy and well-deserved retirement. The Coast Guard provides around-the-clock search and rescue cover along the North Norfolk coast. It works alongside other coastal safety services, like the RNLI, to respond to medical emergencies, missing persons and stranded vessels.
Norwich's biggest bus company, First Bus, would not say how many Revenue Protection Officers, RPOs, it currently employs on its Norwich routes, but said all the roles were under consultation. The bus company introduced the black-clad inspectors 2 years ago to catch fare dodgers after it found one of the biggest forms of fare evasion was adults buying child tickets to travel half price. But the enforcement officers have been accused of being aggressive and rude to passengers, some of whom said they had been unfairly chucked off buses. Describing one incident, passenger Catherine Essex said, "We witnessed a foreign student getting dragged off the bus recently who had a UEA ID but was asked for further ID, despite barely being able to understand English. The inspectors are intimidating and it's unnerving for passengers." Another woman who travels on First Bus previously described the inspectors as clearly overdressed for their role and looked more like police from a TV show. An 18-year-old Norwich student also said he was thrown off a bus by inspectors when using a student pass because he did not have the correct form of ID. The number of passengers reporting the inspectors became so numerous in 2024 that Norwich MPs Clive Lewis and Alice MacDonald contacted First Bus about the inspectors. The bus firm, however, counteracted these claims, saying officers are being regularly monitored and no evidence has been found that they have behaved inappropriately. Commenting on potential redundancies, First Bus spokesman said, "We continually review and manage our operation structure effectiveness, and as a result, the revenue protection officers across our entire business, not just in Norwich, have been placed at risk of redundancy. We cannot comment further on ongoing consultation." The company declined to comment on how many jobs were at risk. However, some say despite their flaws, the inspectors are necessary to support busy drivers who do not have enough time to enforce the rules. John Peacock, 74, an ex-First Bus driver of 18 years, said, "It is a false economy making them redundant because people will start taking rides for free. They had 8 or 10 and made some redundant already, and now they have 3. They are trying to hang on to their jobs. The uniforms were intimidating, and there was no need for that. And I do not think they had sufficient customer service training. I think they should be kept and reformed, not made redundant. It acts as a deterrent."
Families in Norfolk can save money with free bus travel for children this summer. The scheme, part of the government's Great British Summer Savings Initiative, means children aged 5 to 15 will be able to travel without charge on many bus routes throughout August. Five major operators are participating in the scheme: First Bus, Sanders, Stagecoach, Border Bus and Central Connect. It is designed to support families during the school holidays while promoting the use of public transport. Tom Dickerson, Norfolk County Council's Cabinet Member for Highways and Transport, said, "I'm thrilled that so many of our operators are taking part in this scheme. Providing free travel for all 5 to 15-year-olds will not only give our younger residents more freedom to get around this summer, but also reduces the costs for families who want to get out and about and enjoy what our beautiful county has to offer." Children under 5 already travel free on all bus services across Norfolk. Many attractions across the county are also part of the National Good Journey Initiative, which offers incentives and discounts for people arriving car-free.
A man who lost his partner of 30 years to cancer is walking England's coastal path in her memory. Vince Stewart, 64, from Sculthorpe near Fakenham, has so far completed just under 100 miles of the 2,700-mile trek which he began in May. Mr. Stewart, who works in a cafe in Wells, expects to take up to 18 months to finish the route in stages. He is undertaking the challenge in honour of Rosie Noon, who was a long-serving nurse at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in King's Lynn. In March 2025, I lost my partner of 30 years to metastatic lung cancer, he said. It was sudden, devastating and life-changing. This walk is my way of honouring her life, carrying her memory forward and doing something positive in the face of that loss. This week, Mr. Stewart will be walking the 40 miles of coast from Hopton to Cromer, which completes the Norfolk leg of his journey, which he has christened Ramble for Rosie. He then plans to start tackling the Lincolnshire coast, heading north from Broston. It's a long journey, one step at a time, but every mile walked is dedicated to raising money for cancer research and helping others who are facing this disease, he said. Some days will be tough, but I'll keep going, driven by love, memory, and the hope that better treatments and one day cures can be found. Mr. Stewart is documenting his journey for a planned book, which will cover his personal reflections on how he has found a purpose in the wake of his loss, as well as points of interest along the coastal path. He has so far raised £2,500 towards his £200,000 target, which will be donated to his chosen charity, Cancer Research. Donations can be made via an online fundraising page for Cancer Research, which also carries updates on how the walk is progressing.
A project supporting children and young people's mental health has received international recognition. YMCA Norfolk's Professional Therapeutic Pathway, PTP, was named the winner of the inaugural Global Community Wellbeing Impact Awards at the 21st YMCA World Council in Toronto, Canada. It is the first organisation globally to receive this accolade. The project, funded by the Norfolk and Suffolk Integrated Care Board, has reduced waiting times for children and young people in Norfolk from more than a year to less than 55 days. John Lee, Chief Executive of YMCA Norfolk, said, "This award is international recognition of the difference being made here in Norfolk. We are incredibly proud to be the first organisation to receive the Global Community Wellbeing Impact Award. It reflects the outstanding work of our PTP team and therapists and exemplifies the shared values, quality and commitment that run throughout YMCA Norfolk. Offering more than 60 different pathways to well-being, the PTP scheme has reached more than 1,200 young people since 2023. Around 80% of those supported have reported improved well-being, Mr. Lee said, YMCA Norfolk has been recognised not just for delivering therapy, but for our belief in relationships, supporting families, seeing the whole person, and never giving up on a young person. It is hugely encouraging to see those values recognised on the world stage. The YMCA World Council event is the largest gathering in the global YMCA movement, with more than 1,300 delegates from over 100 YMCAs worldwide in attendance. Carlos Madri Sanvi, Secretary General of World YMCA, said, "The Therapeutic Pathways Project perfectly illustrates what YMCA does. It transforms lives." PTP was selected ahead of finalists from Australia, Singapore, and the United States. Judges praised PTP's innovative approach to reducing waiting times and its commitment to providing holistic, relationship-based care that supports young people and their families.
A landmark heritage building could become greener under new plans to install more than 140 solar panels on its roof. Wells Maltings Trust has applied to install the photovoltaic panels at Wells Maltings and the adjacent Sackhouse building on Staithe Street in the town. It says the panels would help it to cut carbon emissions and reduce long-term energy costs. The rising cost of energy presents a significant challenge to the long-term sustainability of community buildings and charitable organisations, it adds in a planning statement. The proposals would preserve the essential character and significance of the listed buildings, preserve the architectural form of the buildings, deliver substantial renewable energy generation, and improve financial sustainability. The Trust said the project would allow more of its income to be directed towards arts, heritage and community activities. The two buildings with historic links to Wells' commercial and maritime past now serve as a theatre and performance venue and community activities hub. They attract more than 40,000 visitors a year and support nearly 30 community groups and businesses. The Trust says the installation represents a practical and proportionate response to the climate emergency, whilst ensuring that the heritage significance of the buildings remains protected. The proposals secure environmental, social, and economic benefits simultaneously, and therefore represent sustainable development in its broadest sense. The Maltings Buildings is leased to the Wells Maltings Trust under a 999-year agreement from North Norfolk District Council. The 19th-century former Maltings complex reopened to the public in 2018 after a major refurbishment. Wells was a major malting town from the 18th century, at one point boasting about a dozen maltings supplying a large share of England's malt exports by sea, especially to Holland.
A new chief executive has taken the helm at a leading social justice charity based in Norwich. Kate Price has stepped into the role at Norfolk Community Law Service, NCLS, following the departure of David Powles, who has become the CEO of homelessness charity St Martin's. NCLS supports thousands of people each year with issues including debt, housing, family law, immigration, domestic abuse, and welfare benefits. Lawrence Harris, Chair of Trustees at NCLS, said, "The entire team welcomes Kate as the new CEO, bringing important new skills and expertise into the organisation." Ms. Price brings more than 20 years of leadership experience across the voluntary sector, health integration, community services, and local government, and most recently served as Assistant Director for Communities at Ipswich Borough Council. She has also held roles at Great Yarmouth Borough Council, Norwich City Council, and national charities. Ms. Price said, "I'm honoured to join the organisation and look forward to working with staff, volunteers and partners to strengthen and grow our impact for local communities. NCLS plays a vital role across Norfolk. You are listening to edition number 2028 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 31st of July 2026. Still to come are planning news, rail updates, marine mammal alerts, invasive hornets in the area, and of course the Mardler magazine. But before all that, here are this week's obituaries.
Diana Mary Eckroyd sadly passed away with her family at her side at Suncourt Nursing Home on July the 3rd, 2026, aged 98 years old. Loving and most dear wife of the late Jack, wonderful and most loving mother to Ian, Jane, Stuart, Malcolm and Jeremy. Loving mother-in-law to Terry and Linda. Loving nanny to Tanya, Gabby, Braden, Callum and Kerry, and great nanny to Charlton, Ariana, Ethan, Ezra and Oliver. Auntie to Julie, sadly missed by Jeff, Megan and Liam. Thanks to all the staff at Suncourt Nursing Home for their excellent care and for the kindness and respect always shown to all the family. The funeral will take place at Cromer Crematorium on Thursday, August the 13th at 3:30 p.m. Family flowers only, please. Donations in aid of the Royal Osteoporosis Society or Alzheimer's Society, if desired, can be given at the service or can be sent care of Cromer and District Independent Funeral Services, 32 West Street, Cromer, NR27 9DS. Alternatively, donations can be made online under funeral notices at www.cromerandistrictfunerals.co.uk.
June Willingdale of Sheringham died on July the 23rd, aged 85 years. Loving wife of the late Les, mum to Sue, Fran and Andy, and gran to Jack and Emily. Her funeral will take place at 2:30 p.m. on Tuesday, August the 18th at Cromer Crematorium. Family flowers only, but donations in Jew's memory are welcome for the Alzheimer's Society. Cheques payable to the charity may be sent care of Blythe and Sons Funeral Director, 4 Cremer Street, Sheringham, NR26 8DZ. Or donate online at northnorfolkfuneralservices.co.uk.
And now, here are some articles about local events and establishments to tempt you out and about in your area.
Bank of Bronze has been crowned Stalham World Cup winner 2026 in the town's month-long sweepstake. Dozens of high street businesses signed up to the competition, each randomly paired with one of the nations taking part in this summer's tournament. As their teams kicked off around the world, shops and cafes enjoyed their own moment in the spotlight, with window displays and social media shout-outs, helping to turn match days into must-visit occasions in the town centre. Eden Plants, flying the flag for Norway, went toe-to-toe with Boots England, while the Grebes Argentina were drawn against Switzerland, represented by Cordron's Butchers. Later in the tournament, organised by Stalham Town Council, Boots and Stalham Stoves faced off in a third-place playoff representing England and France. When Spain lifted the trophy, Bank of Bronze did the same, becoming the first name engraved on the town's replica World Cup. The winning shop will now display the cup for the next 4 years, until the next World Cup takes place.
The Sunday Times listed the 20 most beautiful places in the UK, with North Norfolk Coast making it into the rankings at number 15 on the list. It was described by travel experts at the paper as like a watercolour painting, and was included in the list which also featured the Jurassic Coast as well as parts of Yorkshire. The paper wrote, North Norfolk is like a watercolour painting in which land, sea and sky seem to merge seamlessly into one another. Migrating wildfowl fly in the skies overhead and seal colonies loll around on sandbanks. Towns such as Burnham Market, with its art galleries and fine dining, are surprisingly posh. But then, maybe that shouldn't be a surprise, given that Holcombe Hall, the residence of the Earl of Leicester, and Sandringham, the royal country retreat, are not far away.
The owner of a gallery is marking an incredible first year in a Norfolk town with an exclusive night. Wendy Rendell is celebrating a year since she opened the doors to her gallery, Wherry Arts and Crafts, in North Walsham's marketplace. From pottery, woodwork and homeware to jewellery, paintings and needlework, it offers a range of creations from local talent across the two floors. And to mark the milestone, she's opening the gallery for longer and offering visitors a glass of Prosecco to enjoy at the store. Ms. Rendell said, "It's hard to believe it's already been a year since we opened our doors, and what an incredible first year it's been. The most rewarding part has been building wonderful relationships with our local community and seeing so many people embrace and support independent artists. North Walsham is fast becoming a destination for arts and crafts, and I'm proud that our gallery is part of that growing creative scene. Every sale, visit and conversation has helped to make the first year such a success. A huge thanks to all our customers, artists and followers for your support over the past year. Here's to many more years of creativity together."
The Host Arms, a 17th century coaching inn in Burnham Market, was reviewed in The Times, which described it as a wonderfully pubby pub and gave it a respectable overall score of 7 out of 10. The review follows its refurbishment by Young's Brewery, which refreshed the bar and restaurant while retaining its traditional character. The revamped venue has proved popular with locals, including the village cricket team. The review said, "It's a wonderfully pubby pub and seems to have earned approval from the local cricket team, who go there for a post-match debrief over beers on the terrace. They have good taste." The review praised the proper belt-loosening portions of food, describing the menu as a well-balanced mix of pub standards and more refined dishes. Breakfast options also impressed.
The Earl Arms in Haydon, which dates back to the 16th century, had been run by Andrew Harrison for 26 years. He decided to hand it over to the Haydon estate in December last year, which is now working to reopen it with Norwich-based Bread Hospitality. The team had prepared to open in April, but the renovation work required was far more extensive than they had first hoped. Tom Ginn, the founder of Bread Hospitality, has provided an update. "As we look to finish the final touches, we are thrilled to let you know we will be opening our doors to everyone from Friday the 31st of July. The aim is to showcase Norfolk by having brilliant service and good food filled with local produce," said Mr. Ginn in January. More information will be provided about the opening on the pub's social media in the lead up to the opening.
The Bump, a popular cliff-top viewpoint overlooking the North Norfolk coast, has become home to a simple but heartfelt idea, inviting visitors to pause and share their thoughts. Earlier this year, a local couple placed a notebook at the site for walkers to jot down memories, reflections, and messages inspired by the sweeping views. The idea quickly proved a hit, with the first book filling up and a second volume taking its place. But there was a moment of worry when the latest book appeared to have gone missing. Sharing their concerns on a community Facebook group, the couple described the loss as a huge shame, saying the book had encouraged people to sit and reflect and had gathered lovely contributions. Fortunately, the mystery was short-lived. The notebook was later found further down the bump by Nikita Douglas, who spotted it halfway down the slope toward the putting green, meaning the project can continue to bring a touch of joy to visitors.
A pick-your-own dahlia field designed to feel like a secret garden is opening to the public this weekend. Wild Dahlia Co. will open at 10 a.m. on Saturday, with visitors able to explore rows and rows of colourful dahlias. Harriet Henderson and Eleanor Ames started the business at Breck Farm, Weybourne, after they decided they wanted to create a peaceful project alongside their day-to-day lives. Miss Henderson and Miss Ames said, "Our style is wild, beautiful and a bit untamed. That's what our dahlias are, what the farm is, and what we hope every visitor experiences when they visit." Tickets cost £5 and can be booked online. They give visitors a two-hour slot to explore the new field, wander the rows and pick dahlias. The sessions will only be available on Saturdays and Sundays.
A stay in a luxury coastal holiday home in North Norfolk is up for grabs as part of a new competition launched by Norfolk Brewery Woodfords, giving fans of its wherry ale the chance to win a getaway. James Ram, head of sales, said, "We're incredibly excited to launch our new wherry competition. We all know the unique charm Norfolk holds, from its picturesque sandy beaches to quaint villages and proper pubs serving up some of the finest food and drink available anywhere in the country. This competition is all about showcasing the very best of our county and giving our valued customers the chance of a relaxing coastal retreat in our favourite corner of the world. The top prize includes a stay for up to four people in a luxury holiday home, courtesy of Norfolk Coast Holiday Cottages. Entries can be made by scanning QR codes on wherry promotional materials in participating pubs."
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear of the raptures of reading about a raptor, the Heidi High heritage holidays of the 1950s and 60s, a chain-smoking sweetheart still sung about on YouTube, and some notes on the notes sung by our feathered friends.
Our first article, written by Victoria Jill and published on the BBC News website of the 24th of July 2026, reports on how scientists have found the secret of birdsong's spectacular diversity. Scientists in France say they have discovered the building blocks of the incredible diversity of birdsong. A team analysed more than 100,000 songs from 3,000 bird species and revealed that they are all composed of eight fundamental types of sound that the researchers call motifs. Each song, they say, is made up of combinations of these motifs: three types of trill, three types of whistle, chaotic notes and harmonies. Birdsong is one of the natural world's most sophisticated forms of sound-based communication. Its variety and complexity has fascinated biologists, but with so many different songs, it has been difficult to study on a global scale. Lead researcher and University of Saint-Étienne PhD student Quentin Bacalé explained, "The diversity is huge, and if you go to Asia, Africa, Amazonia, you will hear totally different songs." In a new study, he and his colleagues used a global database of birdsong, recordings uploaded by thousands of volunteers. This meant they could analyse about 116,000 songs from more than 3,000 birdsong species. They studied patterns in the songs, how each song shifted and changed through time. And with the help of AI, they could then compare the thousands of songs to each other to find what connected them. The scientists said this unveiled a simplicity underlying the spectacular diversity of bird songs. A key finding was that the environment the birds evolved in, from tropical forest to temperate landscape, shaped how they composed their songs. So birds adapted for tropical forests use different acoustic building blocks or motifs to those from temperate regions. Simpler motifs like flat whistles are often found in tropical environments, apparently because they help the birds make themselves heard through the busy biodiverse soundscape and dense vegetation. More complex compositions with ultra-fast trills and combinations that contain lots of information are more common in temperate forests where birds tend to communicate at closer range. It's a kind of evolutionary trade-off. A very complex song provides a lot of information, but it is difficult to transmit that information over long distances in complex environments. This link between the environment and its natural soundscape, Bakele explained, is being transformed by human activity. I think this research has opened up a new way to see songs as something intrinsically linked with the environment, he told BBC News. So we could try to use these motifs to help us understand how birds could adapt to the new background noise that we produce. Natural sound, Bakele added, is an important part of our own connection to nature and is worth conserving. If you think of a forest near your town or near your house, you think about the songs of the birds in the morning when you go outside. And if a bird in a forest has a specific song, if you destroy the forest, then that song may not be adapted anymore to the new environment. This article includes a number of colourful images of birds. In one, a bright green magpie with a striking orange beak and jet black feathers around its eyes peers at the camera while perched on a branch. This tropical Javan green magpie is critically endangered. In another, a songbird in a tropical forest perches in a tree with its beak open wide in song. It is a three-wattled bellbird with a russet orange-coloured body, a bright white head, black eyes, and black wattles, appendages dangling from its head. And a final image shows a small, agile-looking songbird with blue-grey wings and back, a peachy orange chest and belly, and a black flash across its eye. It perches in a leafy tree, looking from right to left, and appears to be about to take off. This is a Eurasian nuthatch.
Nicola Chester wrote this article for the autumn edition of the RSPB magazine. John Alec Baker, author of The Peregrine in 1967, would have been 100 this August. Published 5 years after Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, Baker won acclaim and awards, alerting readers to the plight of the bird and its prey, becoming one of our most important and singular nature writers. I first read The Peregrine in fits and starts in my 20s. A budding new nature writer and an environmental activist, it was an emotional, heady time. Quote, "The peregrine lives in a pouring away world of no attachment, a world of wakes and tilting," unquote. And the cause of stone curlews, quote, "fossil voices released from the strata of the chalk," unquote. I recognise the anguish, love, rage and strangeness of his words and couldn't read it all at once. It called to mind teenage fears I'd only just left behind and laid bare ones we were facing. It read like a cinematic flash of an age, all frightening lonely water safety ads of the 1980s, nuclear threats, chainsawed hedgerows and chemical pollution. The post-pastoral backlit by beauty, accompanied by an operatic score. It intensified a yearning to write from a female perspective of a different generation. It challenged me. The Peregrine is a high-octane, passionate and relentless field guide of brilliance, brutalism and imagination that reads like a novel. It compresses 10 years of observations following peregrines on bike and foot around the Essex estuarine landscape into one season. It is pervaded by loss and the changes wrought by recent war. Baker saw London devastated in the Blitz and the post-war destruction of nature, yet he soars and plummets with the birds. He strives to become them, mantling their prey remains, divining kills, cloud banks and wind direction, before returning to office work and the Chelmsford Council House he shared with his wife, Doreen. It is a divisive book. If it's a work of non-fiction and field observation, how is some of it possible? Are some peregrines misidentified, or is this Baker's persistent witness, seeing behaviour others haven't, or that's altered by chemical poisoning of the food chain? But he preempts many of these questions in his book, House of Sky, of literary, poetic and imaginative license. Authentic, transcendent, we fall in love with the birds and are compelled to reach for something better for them as, quote, many die on their backs, clutching insanely at the sky in their last convulsions, withered and burnt away by the filthy, insidious pollen of farm chemicals, unquote. That is exactly what happened. I have not revisited the book since, and wonder how it has aged, but I still feel its burning intensity. Most of us delight in nature that pops up before something else catches our attention. Unless we are a scientist, passionate observer, writer or artist, we rarely have the kind of sustained, experiential laser focus on a species that Baker had. That kind of intensity takes us deeper into the world and further from it too. But when we return, we are enriched, our perspective altered, slightly wounded, and more in love with the world than ever.
Molly Wingley, she smokes like a chimney, but she's my little nicotine gal.
Following on from our article about the Boy John letters a few weeks ago, this week we reminisce about the Norfolk Singing First. In a new paragraph from the Archives of the Fellows of Norfolk Dialect via the EDP Archives, we read, Alan Smethurst was raised in Sheringham from the age of 11, his mother coming from the village of Stiffkey. He joined the post office in 1953 and hummed tunes on his daily round for 12 years, writing and singing songs in his native Norfolk dialect. An audition tape sent to the BBC earned him a spot on Ralph Tuck's BBC East Regional Radio programme, Wednesday Morning. His popularity led to Tuck recording Smethurst on his own record label, the smallest recording organisation in the world, based in Lowestoft. A4 Track EP made the EP charts in 1965. This was followed by another EP released by Tuck album, The Singing Postman's Year. He was then signed to EMI, who re-released earlier songs and recorded new items. A film on YouTube summarised the life and times of Alan Smethurst. You can search YouTube for The Singing Postman, Have You Got a Loyt Boy? Promo video 1967. In 1966, the Singing Postman's best-known hit, Have You Got a Light Boy, won Smethurst the Ivor Novello Award for the Best Novelty Song of the Year. A colour promotional film was made, which has survived till this day. He made numerous live and promotional performances, including appearing on Top of the Pops alongside the Rolling Stones. The song had a small comeback in 1994 when it featured in a television commercial for Ovaltine. Smethurst left the music industry in 1970, citing stage fright and arthritic hands. He later admitted to an alcohol problem and revealed all his earnings were gone and he was penniless. He spent his last 20 years living quietly in a Salvation Army hostel in Grimsby, where he died from a heart attack in December 2000. Searching on YouTube will give you access to a lot more information and to most of Alan's recorded repertoire, including I Can't Get a Nice Loaf of Bread. Here's a very short extract to encourage you to research him further.
I can get myself a nice lobster or a nice broad apron crab when I'm a little bit hungry. A nice little herring I've had. I can get myself a nice mushroom to go along a regular in bed. I can get myself a nice mother, but I can't get a nice loaf of bread.
Returning to the boy John and his letters, also from the EDP archives, we finish with some quotes from his fictional aunt. Aunt Agatha, she say, "You can always tell a Norfolk man, but you can't tell him much." She say, "That's a pity. We can't live in the past. It'd be so much cheaper." She say, "If a woman wants to spend a few minutes on her own, she only need to start washing up." She say, "Trust no memory, however bright. Put it down in black and white." And finally, she say, "The more you say, the less people remember."
I had a gal, wee nice gal, down in Wroxham way. She was really nice to me back in the old school days. She would smile all the while, but Daddy didn't know all what she used to say to me behind the garden wall. Have we got a light, boy? Have we got a light?
Emma Brennan wrote this article for the North Norfolk News on July the 16th, 2026. This time of year always fills me with joyous memories of looking forward to our summer holiday. It was nothing lavish by today's standards, just a week away somewhere on the British coast. These days, remaining in this country is often referred to as a staycation. But to us as kids in the 1970s, that was our only holiday option. At that time, relatively few people went abroad, and if they did, it was usually Spain or somewhere close. I don't recall any of my school friends going to Disneyland, for example. The vast majority stayed in British seaside resorts, and instead of an all-inclusive package holiday to Tenerife, opted for the homegrown equivalent, a holiday camp. These offered organised family entertainment along with the food and accommodation. There was little need to venture off camp with everything you required on site. A far cry from the globe-trotting holidays many aspire to these days. I always remember being mighty impressed when a school friend told me she was going on holiday to California. It seemed beyond possibility that you could get on a plane and jet off to America for a holiday. I was thinking palm trees, sun-drenched beaches and surfable waves. I was suitably deflated to discover she was actually going to California Sands, a holiday camp on the East Anglian coast. This is because holiday camps were never really my thing, probably not helped by the iconic 1980s British sitcom Heidi High, which was set at the fictional Maplin's Holiday Camp in 1959 and 1960. As creative kids with good imaginations, we didn't much fancy regimented activities, so the nearest we got to a holiday camp was a week in a very basic seaside, so-called chalet park, with a clubhouse for entertainment. Nonetheless, plenty of people have a real fondness for holiday camps, which have a long history in Britain. The first, Cunningham's Camp, was established in 1894 on the Isle of Man. Accommodation was intense and the stay included basic outdoor activities. By 1939, more than 300 holiday camps had been founded across the UK, ranging from 50 to 6,000 bed sites, mostly in huts or chalets. Probably the best known was Butlin's, founded by William, Billy Butlin, in 1936 in Skegness. The main British rival was Pontins, established after the Second World War in 1946. From the end of the war through the 1950s and 60s, many smaller local holiday camps popped up, cashing in on what had become a thriving industry. Entertainment was led by a multi-talented staff, instantly recognisable by the colour of their blazers. Butlin's was famous for its red coats and Pontins for its blue coats. Being a holiday camp entertainer ignited the careers of many a future, such as Jimmy Tarbuck, Bradley Walsh and Shane Ritchie. For me, activities organised by people in brightly coloured jackets presented too many opportunities to be singled out. I've mentioned before how acutely embarrassed I have always been at the thought of making a show of myself, and consequently I do not like dancing, karaoke or activities with audience participation in any shape or form. I get this from my mum, who didn't even want to shout aloud when she had a full house on the one occasion we went to bingo. These days, holiday camps have evolved into more sophisticated parks, with luxury lodges, caravans and even yurts, vastly different to the basic tented accommodation of Cunningham's day. There was no such thing as glamping in those days. High-end versions such as Centre Parks offer a highly modernised incarnation of the old-style holiday camps, with cosy cabins, tree houses nestled in woodland settings, and multiple outdoor activities for the adventurous. I did try one of the new breed of holiday parks when I was in my early 20s after being persuaded by a bossy acquaintance. It was supposed to be relaxing in tranquil surroundings with spa treatments available. Granted, the chalet was comfortable and in a great spot, but the activities I was controlled into trying included attempting to swim in a pool full of children who screamed every time the wave function kicked in, and cycling around bumpy paths on what felt like the world's most uncomfortable bicycle. The final straw was a horse riding excursion, my first since the bolting on the beach incident, which had made me vow never to get on a horse's back again. But in an attempt to get into the group activity spirit, I complied, first telling the stable owner I was nervous and required a suitably calm horse. The upshot is that I was paired with a nag named Walter, who was so chilled he was virtually comatose. Despite repeated attempts to get him to move, he remained with hooves firmly rooted to the spot in the stable yard, long after the others had trotted off into the tree-lined yonder. I think that really summed up my experience with horses and holiday camps.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the author of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of news stories cover planning and council matters.
North Norfolk must find space for nearly 14,000 new homes, and locals have just 6 weeks to say where they should go. A new local plan, scoping consultation, has opened, asking people what should be built and where growth should be focused, as the district is reshaped to 2045. Under new housing requirements, North Norfolk District Council's housing target has been raised by 65%. The council must provide for at least 932 homes a year from 2029, up from 557, meaning almost 14,000 new dwellings over the plan period. The current plan, adopted in December 2025, runs to 2040, but national changes mean the council must prepare a fresh local plan. It must now cover 2029 to 2045 on a 30-month timetable, starting by October the 31st. A consultation has been launched asking for local views on what the plan should contain. Council figures show the district's seven towns and one large village, North Walsham, Fakenham, Cromer, Holtsdalem, Wells Next the Sea and Hoveton, together have a population of about 40,000. A further 63,000 people live in smaller settlements and the countryside, giving a total of 103,000. Broad's Bulletin, an online group, raised concerns on a social media post. Where does the council envisage an expanded Hoveton going, other than into the open countryside towards its neighbouring villages? The scoping consultation document explains the issues being considered and the evidence the council intends to prepare. A separate call for sites consultation is running over the same period for landowners and developers to submit potential development sites for assessment. Consultations are running online until Monday, August the 31st at 5 p.m.
The owner of a luxury glamping spot on the Broads has defended his plans to offer guests beers and wine, saying, "We're not a Wetherspoon." Luke Patterson, who runs Dillam Hall Retreats near Stalham with his wife Louise, has faced opposition to proposals to sell alcohol to guests and play music. The plans also involve hosting weekly beer and pizza-style pop-up events at the site, which features 13 glamping pods. Objectors have accused the family for not being clear on what their plans involve, claiming they could lead to noise and disturbances in the quiet village. One woman said, "Most of the time, folks show their consideration to their neighbours, keeping their noise to a bare minimum. I don't want to wake up wondering whether today is one of those pop-up days when who knows how many people will descend on the site less than a kilometre away from us. I don't want to have to wear ear defenders in my own garden. I don't want our lives to be blighted like this." But at a meeting of North Norfolk District Council Licensing Subcommittee, Mr. Patterson, a fifth-generation farmer, insisted he wants to maintain the peace and tranquility of the Oak Road venue. He said, "The first spend when you go away on holiday is your accommodation, and that is the most important thing to us. We just want to enhance that a little bit. We're not trying to run a Wetherspoons here. We're just trying to enhance our guests' stay so that they get to meet Louise and I in a relaxed, informal way and we get to sell them a drink." The original plans wanted the sought-after activities to take place between 9 a.m. and 11 p.m, but this was revised to 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. following concerns raised by the Broads Authority. As part of the bid, Mr. Patterson said he wanted to host the 200th anniversary canal festival planned by North Walsham and Dillam Canal Trust later this summer. A decision will be made on the proposal in due course.
Aylsham could soon be getting a fresh injection of ink as plans are lodged to bring a tattoo studio into the heart of town. Norwich-based Cavalry Tattoo Studio has applied to North Norfolk District Council to open a new premises in the marketplace, taking over a currently vacant office unit. The proposal seeks permission to change the building's use to allow it to operate as a tattoo studio. The business, which has been running in Norwich for 7 years, has built up a client base that travels from across the UK and sometimes overseas for appointments. In a planning statement, the applicant said, We've built a great relationship with our current neighbouring businesses and hope to do the same again in Aylsham. If approved, the studio would run on an appointment-only basis with bookings made online, meaning no signage or external alterations to the building are planned. The new site would be staffed by 4 tattoo artists, including 3 full-time and 1 part-time. No decision has yet been made on the application.
A contentious motion by Reform councillors to consider how members who make controversial, offensive, shocking or provocative comments are protected has been approved. Reform councillors at Norfolk County Council said their call for a review of the authority's constitution to recognise that remarks should not be discouraged simply because some people find them offensive, unpopular or controversial was to highlight the importance of freedom of expression. But political opponents said it could make political debate more hostile and questioned whether it was motivated by a desire to dodge standard complaints for comments made, including on social media. The motion called for a forthcoming review of the Council's constitution to consider how Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which protects the rights of freedom of expression, relates to the Code of Conduct of councillors. The Code of Conduct outlines how councillors are expected to behave and is used to determine whether their actions have breached it, which can lead to sanctions. The motion was proposed by Reform councillor Jaden Lister. In order to be able to think, you have to risk being offensive. That is life. That is fact. As a young man, I see every single day that our freedoms and liberties are eroding before our very own eyes. We live in a country where we imprison more people for hate speech than Russia. Free speech is for all, not for the privileged few. Green councillor Tom Ludson questioned whether the aim of the motion was to subvert standards complaints. Conservative group leader Kay Mason-Billig said Article 10 was already part of the law, so there was no need to restate it in the council's constitution. She asked Reform councillors, what is it that you want to say that you believe you cannot do today? We are here to do a job, not to cover our backsides from criticism. Towards the end of the debate, proposer Mr. Lister revealed that Mrs. Mason-Billig previously lodged a standards complaint, which he termed a love letter, about one of his social media posts, which showed her holding a Rainbow Alliance sign under the headline, Wokeism over Conservatism. The council's monitoring officer, who investigates complaints, deemed there was no need to take the matter any further. Reform's motion was agreed at Tuesday's, July the 21st, full council meeting with 45 votes for, 22 against and 10 abstentions.
Our last few articles include a tribute to Bill Oddie, plus trains, whales and hornets' nests.
Bill Oddie rose to fame as part of 1970s comedy trio The Goodies before his love of birdwatching led him to presenting BBC wildlife programmes. His agent and friend David Foster said, "It is with deep sadness that I announce the passing of Bill Oddie, the country's best-loved birder." Bill was a multi-talented celebrity, wildlife presenter, broadcaster, comedian, writer, songwriter, musician, and conservationist. Yet it was never fame that he valued. Instead, he encouraged us to respect and protect the environment. He taught us the wonder of it. He protested, lobbied, and campaigned for it. He led the way, and people of all ages and backgrounds responded to his call. Oddie's broadcaster career included Bill Oddie Goes Wild, first broadcast in 2002, of which one episode followed him as he explored country byways, starting with the dawn song of a nightingale and ending at Titchwell Marsh near Hunstanton. North Norfolk was also the backdrop in Birding with Bill Oddie, 1997, when he trained his binoculars on birds migrating along the East Coast in July and September. In another episode, he explored the county's farmland in late July, observing stone curlews, grey partridges and corn buntings. He also presented the BBC's flagship Spring Watch programme from 2005 to 2008. Chris Packham, who replaced him as the show's main host the following year, described him as delightfully unpredictable and an utter joy to be with. Beyond broadcasting, he was known for his activism and environmental campaigning and was awarded an OBE for his work in 2003. Oddie was a long-standing vice president of the RSPB and also a member of its council. Becky Spate, chief executive of the charity, said, "We are saddened by the death of Bill Oddie, whose love and knowledge of birds inspired millions. As a much-loved broadcaster and naturalist, Bill encouraged people to not only notice, but respect and protect the natural world around them. His legacy will live on in every person he inspired. Bill Oddie leaves his wife, Laura, and his daughters, Bonnie, Kate and Rosie."
A Norfolk branch line has seen one of the country's biggest increases in passenger numbers, with a quadrupling of the figures in the last 30 years. Journeys on the Bitten line, which runs between Sheringham and Norwich, have soared by 313% since 1994, rising from just over 200,000 a year to more than 827,000. The increase is put down to changes in the service, including the introduction of more regular trains, as well as the expansion of tourism and population growth along the 30-mile, 10-station line. Jonathan Denby, 58, head of corporate affairs at Anglia Railways, which operates on the line, said its success was also down to a long-running partnership between the firm and the communities which live along it. "The community partnership is an approach where the railway and the local community, usually local authorities, work together to promote routes like this which have real value locally," he said. "If the railway thrives, so does the local community and vice versa," he said. "The massive increase in passenger numbers is a real mark of the collective success of improving the service and making sure it is connected with the local community. The Bitten Line partnership was launched with Norfolk County Council in the late 1990s and has helped fund improvements and ensure services cater to passengers' needs. It has also allowed the company to receive feedback from the customers and make appropriate changes, such as additional weekend stops, including recent Sunday services at West Runton." Mr. Denby, who lives in Norwich and has worked closely with North Norfolk Line since 1994, added, "In just over 30 years, the number of people using the line has quadrupled, which is just wonderful for a local line in lovely North Norfolk. The Bitten Line, named after the Broadland bird, following an EDP reader competition in the 1990s, serves Broads villages like Salhouse, Hofton and Wroxham, as well as the town of North Walsham and resorts of Sheringham and Cromer. Services are now hourly every day, all year round, with more than 97% of trains arriving within 3 minutes of schedule."
As National Whale and Dolphin Week arrives on the North Norfolk coast, wildlife spotters are training their binoculars on the horizon in the hope of a rare fin, splash or blow. Although sightings of the marine mammals are classed as rare rather than commonplace, there has been a steady trickle of sightings off Norfolk in recent years. Using reports from the Sea Watch Foundation sightings map, here are five spots where there is a chance of seeing a porpoise or dolphin, with the odd whale as an outside bet. West Runton. The Runtons are a common spot to see marine wildlife, with a pod of 8 to 10 photographed just 400 metres off East Runton on August 14, 2023, by Sheringham photographer Chris Taylor. Blakeney. In 2023, at least two dolphins were seen off the Blakeney coast. Blakeney Point itself is a low, shifting spit of sand and shingle, fronting a vast national nature reserve of salt marsh dunes and creeks. Winterton. Although there is no official story of a humpback whale off the coast of Winterton, there is a reported sighting from November last year. 2 days later, the whale was reportedly seen off the coast of Sea Pawling, which is just up the road. Winterton Beach is a long run of pale sand backed by high, rolling dunes and stretches of open coastline. Sheringham and Cromer. Dolphins are not a common sight in two of Norfolk's most loved seaside towns, but there have been plenty of porpoise sightings and even a reported minke whale in April last year. In January 2021, a dead sperm whale was found washed up on Sheringham's beach, which was the third sperm whale found along the Norfolk coast that winter. Just down the road at Overstrand, a bottlenose dolphin was seen in 2023. Hunstanton. There has been rare but confirmed sightings of whales near Hunstanton, with a toothed whale reportedly seen in September last year. A 14-metre-long, 46-feet whale was also found dead between Old Hunstanton and Hole next to sea in 2016.
A yellow-legged hornet was reported in Burren near Aylsham on July the 20th. More sightings in the area have been reported on social media, but not officially confirmed. So far this year, 62 credible yellow-legged hornet sightings have been logged nationally, with 16 nests found and destroyed by specialists. The species, sometimes called the Asian hornet, poses a threat to pollinators, particularly honeybees, and officials say early reporting is vital to limit its impact. In May, locals were warned by Andrew Delbridge of the Norfolk-based Ace Pest Control not to panic when seeing the insect. He previously said the county is currently enjoying conditions that are absolutely ideal for Asian hornets. Asian hornets are black or dark brown with a distinctive yellow band at the rear and are slightly smaller than native European hornets.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was David Mitchell. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's cheerio! Cheerio.